War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Think of all the weapons we make around the world. Investing brains and money in the best ways how to kill. If we could use that money for the betterment of man and care about each other, there'd be peace throughout the land. War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Think of all the children who suffered through the war. Think of all the families together, nevermore. Think of all the soldiers who lost both life and limb. Oh, when we fight the battles, no one ever wins. War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Rid the world of weapons, think what we could do. Jobs and education, universal healthcare too. Invest into our future, imagine how it'd be. A cleaner environment, peace and harmony. War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Changes, it never is too late. The world can be a better place, peace stands at the gate. If we join together and finally decide to have the peace that's waiting on the other side. War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Some may say we're crazy, stupid, and naive. We will never live in peace, cause wars will always be. Well, I believe it's possible if we join hand in hand to create a better world with peace in every land. Cause war is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause...
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is about climate change and carbon dioxide. We start off in Studio A with Tom Bowden, who is a scientist and science team leader at the Carbon Dioxide Information Analysis Center. He talks with Bruce Yellerman about the increase in carbon dioxide that is larger than the worst-case scenario suggested by the United Nations. And then off to Studio B with Paul Gilding, who's a professor at Cambridge University Program for Sustainability Leadership, and Richard Heinberg, who's at the Post Carbon Institute and is a journalist and educator. They ask you to think about the economic crisis meeting the environmental crisis. And they say economic growth, as we've known it, is over.
From the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios in Somerville, Massachusetts, this is Living on Earth. I'm Bruce Kellerman. The numbers are grim and the news is worse. We've got 5 years or else. That according to the International Energy Agency, which reports if we don't dramatically cut emissions of greenhouse gases by 2017, we face irreversible, catastrophic climate change. That dire prediction comes on the release of the latest figures showing the amount of climate-changing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is up, way up. 6% just last year. That's the largest increase ever recorded. In fact, it's even worse than the worst-case scenario considered by UN climate scientists. Tom Bowden compiled the CO2 numbers. He's director of the Department of Energy's Carbon Dioxide Information Analysis Center.
Well, from 2009 to 2010 marks the first year ever since 1751 that we've exceeded 9 billion tons of carbon released to the atmosphere from the consumption of fossil fuels. The 6% increase that we saw from 2009 to 2010 also represents the largest single jump that we have ever seen, and we've been doing this now for about 25 years, and constitutes about a half a billion ton increase. So it's quite noteworthy.
You know, these are numbers. When you think about it, is there a way of visualizing it, giving me an image of what we're talking about here?
Well, let me try to equate it to this. Most of us can remember back in 1991 when Kuwait was invaded and many of those oil rigs were set ablaze. The Kuwaiti oil fires resulted in a release of about 130 million metric tons, which is on a par with Canada's annual emissions. So think of that as something of almost four times that magnitude of all of those oil rigs ablaze and continuously spewing carbon into the atmosphere.
But I thought that the global economic recession was slowing the emission of greenhouse gases in general and carbon dioxide in specifically.
Well, that's true, but at least from an emission standpoint, from a fossil fuel consumption standpoint, all indications are that the global financial crisis is over. And you can clearly see countries that were impacted by the crisis and those that weren't. The U.S. was one where, you know, we did feel the impacts of the financial crisis. Emissions dropped in 2009, but rebounded in 2010. Other countries like China seem to show no impact whatsoever from the global financial crisis, and emissions just continue to soar. Half of that roughly 500 million ton increase came from China alone, and the remainder came from mostly Asian countries, India, for example. And again, in the case of those two countries, they're countries that have very large populations, growing economies, and they're also sitting on, you know, large reserves of coal that they are using to meet their growing energy demands.
So when you measure the worldwide atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide, you measure it in ppm, parts per million, right?
That's correct. And we have atmospheric concentration measurements that date back to the late 1950s. And those concentrations show us, those measurements show us that levels of CO2 in the atmosphere have risen from about 315 parts per million to 390 parts per million presently. And certainly, the reason for that rise in atmospheric CO2 is due to fossil fuel consumption.
There's some climate activists who say, you know, at 350, if we go over that KD bar, the door, that we've reached the tipping point and we need to stay around 350. And you're saying we're up to 390 parts per million.
That's correct.
So are we at a tipping point? Have we gone past that?
The emission scenarios that were used in the last IPCC scientific assessment.
Those are the UN science studies.
That's exactly right. The emission scenarios that were used, the trajectory that we're currently on, exceeds some of the most pessimistic of those emission scenarios. And in those scenarios, the model continued to show something on an order of 3 to 5 degrees Celsius global warming. We're on a emissions trajectory that this is not business as usual.
You know, I'm listening to you and I'm wondering, what do we do?
What I tell my children is that we are conducting an experiment with Mother Earth. We don't know the outcome, but certainly human beings are perturbing the atmosphere, the planet that we live on. Some of my kids are alarmed. My youngest one worries about the polar bears and whether they're going to be around. The good news is it's a longer-term problem. I think we need to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. We need to explore alternative energy forms. We need to conserve where we can. We need to look at things like mass transportation. The old adage of think globally, act locally would be my advice. I think, you know, if we all try to be less fossil fuel consumptive in our personal lives, that hopefully it'll have an impact as we try to find bigger solutions down the road.
We've been talking about the dramatic growth in CO2 emissions worldwide with Tom Bowden. Mr. Bowden is director of the Department of Energy's Carbon Dioxide Information Analysis Center at the Oak Ridge National Lab. Well, Mr. Tom Bowden, thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And now on to The Great Disruption with Paul Gilding and Richard Heinberg. Think economic crisis meets environmental crisis.
Welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. Today, we'll explore the limits of economic growth as the primary organizing principle of our society. The American economy has been on a bender. For decades, we've been smoking fossil fuels, snorting consumer debt, and chugging consumer goods. For a while, that felt pretty good. But lately, we're realizing maybe that's not a healthy or sustainable way to live. Is perpetual economic growth possible? Is it desirable? Is it conceivable to construct a steady-state economy that doesn't careen from expansion to contraction? For the next hour, we'll discuss an economy beyond growth here with our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and two authors who've been thinking deeply about what they call an addiction to growth. We're delighted to welcome Paul Gilding, professor at Cambridge University Program for Sustainability Leadership. He's the author of the new book, The Great Disruption: Why the Climate Crisis Will Bring on the End of Shopping and the Birth of a New World. And Richard Heinberg is a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute here in Northern California and the author of The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Please welcome them to Climate One. Thank you both for coming. I think it's fair to say that almost every citizen, certainly every politician and corporate leader in America wants the American economy to grow again. What's wrong with that? Paul Gilding?
It's not going to happen. Is the main problem. And it's not going to happen, I don't mean literally 1% here or there, but fundamentally the idea that we can keep on growing an economy up against the physical limits of the earth in terms of resource availability, oil, climate, water, land, etc., is not physically possible. And so now we're kind of trapped, really, that if we grow the economy significantly again, then we'll hit those limits again, prices will go up, oil prices will go up, food prices will go up, and the economy will go down. If we don't grow the economy, we're going to drown in debt. So we're sort of stuck, if you like, stuck between growth and debt, and therefore we're going to take a while to find our way out of this morass that we've dug ourselves into.
Richard Heinberg, you write about the Great Depression and how the growth, it took 40 years for nominal GDP to come back after the Great Depression. Are we in, is that a similar situation? It's going to take 40 years to get back to where we were?
No, I think it's much worse.
Oh, great.
I don't think we'll ever see growth the way we experienced it during the decades of the 20th century. If we're thinking of growth in terms of increased consumption, then I think it's all over, really. Whether you look at limits to natural resources like oil and other fossil fuels and minerals and metals, or whether you look at the basic model of money being created from debt, we've created an economy that's structurally hitting the wall. In both instances, also the impacts from industrial accidents and natural disasters, we're also seeing burgeoning costs in that area. So if fundamentally, we're going to have to create an economy that exists within nature's limits.
The American consumer, to a large extent, has been the engine of growth, buying stuff, driving the economy for the last couple of decades. And clearly, American consumers are, you know, over their heads in debt. And some people would say, well, the middle class in China and Brazil and India will come along, and they're going to be the consumer drivers for growth.
So it really depends on where you are and what your interest is. So yes, it's certainly true that the U.S. Consumer has done wonderful things for the Chinese economy. By buying all those consumer goods, that's certainly true. But and yes, there will be growth, I think, in those developing countries for some time until they hit their limits. But fundamentally, you kind of have this physical constraint on global growth, which will play out differently in different places. And I think it's particularly difficult in many Western countries, US and Europe in particular, because of the debt constraint. It's easier to get past the limits for a while and sort of go into debt more, if you like, ecologically, if you have lots of financial resources to finance that. The trouble with economies like North America and like Europe is that you haven't got the debt, haven't got the money to drive the process, so you're constrained by debt as well. So I think Richard would agree that we're not talking about a sudden zero growth from now on, you know, absolutely numerically, but we are talking about the system being broken, and that's the place we've got to. So no matter how much we want the Chinese middle class and Indian middle class to overtake the role and drive global growth, that they are still facing the same economic problems of ecological and resource limits.
And so both of you talk about the Earth operating at, the economy is now, what, at 140%? Mm-hmm. There's different numbers out there. We need three Earths or something like that to support everyone living at a Western, European, or American standards. But say we're sitting here in San Francisco, it's a sunny day, mm-hmm. the economy's working, maybe not so great, the buses are moving. Mm-hmm. Where are the limits?
This is what we've been doing. We've been borrowing from the past by way of fossil fuels. This is energy that was captured from sunlight tens of millions of years ago and buried in the ground and turned into energy-dense, cheap, easily accessible fuels. So we've been borrowing from the Earth's past, and we're also borrowing from future generations by way of debt, all so that we can consume as much as possible right now. And we've been pretty successful at that for the last century. But there's only so long you can continue borrowing from both the past and the future to fund present consumption.
And then on a personal level, you know, just back to your point about, because it is very hard. It is very hard to go out and say, look, the world's in a crisis, it's all going to fall apart. Well, it doesn't feel like that. It feels pretty good to me. And it's like living on a credit card. It feels pretty good, right, until the bill comes in. So if you're living on your credit card, you don't notice that your lifestyle can't be afforded. You don't notice you're having nice food, you're buying nice clothes, you're doing the things you want to do, and then one day the bill comes in. And so Richard's point is that the bill is coming in now for the Earth, and as we would lose our house for the credit card bill, we're in danger of losing the big house in terms of the planet.
And you talk about a move to away from sort of this boom and bust cycle from expansion to contraction. You both write about a steady state economy. And Paul, you write about where people work less and spend less. So what does that look like, something beyond growth?
Well, we know that ecosystems function and they change over time. And yet they do that with relatively constant flows of energy and material. New species appear, they outcompete other species, and so on. It's always evolving. Well, that's how the human economy looked for thousands of years up until the 20th century, before we had this period of rapid growth. And that's what it's going to look like after the end of economic growth as well. It's not as though everything's going to come to a grinding halt, but the commerce that proceeds will be proceeding within the limits of what nature can sustainably provide, the renewable energy from the sun and wind and tides and so on, and recycling of non-renewable resources to the absolute limit that we can. It won't be a static economy in the sense that it will constantly look the same, because the human ingenuity will constantly bring on new products, new processes, and so on. But it will be an economy that does not grow in terms of rates of consumption of natural resources.
And in that context, it's important to remember this is not about the end of capitalism or the end of business or the end of change. It's just about it happening within those constraints. So we are going to see amazing new technologies come to the fore, and we are going to see certain companies grow in very exciting ways and produce wonderful new products that will make our lives a lot better. But the reality is, if you're replacing a multi-trillion dollar industry, just coal, oil and gas alone, let alone all the support mechanisms around that, that's a big change. And so you need a lot of growth over here to overcome the collapsing system over there. And therefore, I think the argument that Richard and I would agree upon is that, you know, we are going to go through a difficult period of transition to something different. So it's not that things will stop and things will never change. It's just that the way we do that will have to be done again within those physical constraints of the Earth.
So you're not proposing Stalinist decay or centralized economy. Got it. Okay.
Correct, yeah. Which is a good thing.
Yeah, it's good, certainly. So some companies in some sectors will grow and some will contract, and overall aggregate growth will be slower than what we've been used to seeing.
Yeah.
Okay. Then some would say that, so you would subscribe to the idea that green growth, that the clean technology can be a driver of growth, and that growth is okay. You're not against all growth. You're just saying that growth as we've seen it.
I think it's important to separate what we expect green growth to deliver. So what's wrong with much of the current analysis is that we think it's okay, green growth will save us from a crisis, from a tragedy of the system breaking down.
Technology will save us,
yeah,
right?
And it's a tech-optimist view of the world, and it's been around for a long time, and it's a lovely vision, and I would like to subscribe to it. I used to. I just kept on reading too many books about physics and chemistry, and the rules of that don't seem to comply with my wishes for some reason, which is very annoying. But there you go. So the point is that those technologies, those industries will achieve remarkable things, right, and will grow dramatically, but they will not prevent a climate crisis because it's too late. They will not overcome the limits of physical land available for food. They will not create new water and new sunshine. Right, we actually work within those constraints, and that's the issue we face.
And you write about scream, crash, boom. Tell us what that means in terms of, I'd like to get Richard also in terms of when we will move, what will be the catalyst to drive us toward this ecosystem model of economy.
Yeah, so I wrote a paper in 2005 called Scream, Crash, Boom, and the argument was that the scream was kind of the 50 years of environmentalism, saying, you know, wake up, we have a crisis, and that we had 50 years to change, or our children's children would suffer. And after 50 years, we've become their children's children. Right, so it's on our watch that it's happening, and that's the crash. So the crash is simply that we are now facing, and this is not a forecast, this is measurement. Right? So this is not sort of Malthusian or limits to growth about what would happen in 30 or 40 years' time. This is 2010, 2011 measurements of what's actually occurring. And that is the climate system breaking down, right? That is peak oil being reached. That is, you know, food supply being constrained, so food prices going up. This is the crash that we're in now, and that will unfold further. The boom is simply not so much a boom as in we're all saved by the boom, but the boom will be in the dramatic economic transformation towards a new model. Right? So we are going to see spectacular change in various parts of the economy, but we are not going to see it fast enough now to overcome the physical crisis caused by the limits of resources.
And there'll be a lot of pain in that transition, Richard.
A lot of pain.
Yes, and we're starting to see that now with the collapse of the financial systems that have been built with the expectation of continual growth. It's being called in some quarters a growth crisis. In other words, look at some of the European countries, Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and so on. They ran up enormous amounts of debt. Our own country is sort of in the same category. The assumption was that as the economy grew, then tax revenues would also grow, and we'd be able to service this debt and pay it off. It wouldn't be a larger and larger portion of the national budget. But that assumption is proving wrong as we're hitting these growth limits. One thing that's happening is high oil prices are setting a limit on economic growth, especially in the already industrialized countries like the U.S. With oil prices at $100 a barrel, it's very difficult for the economy to grow. So then that has repercussions on the financial system. So, and then that has repercussions on real people, and it sends them ultimately out into the street, as we've been seeing in Middle East, North Africa, Greece, Ireland, and now the United States.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Well, everywhere is one, it's a one, and until there's no longer first class nor second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, I've got to say why. And until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, it's a war. But until that day, dream of lasting peace, world a citizenship, and the rule of international morality, yeah, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Well, everywhere is war. Until the ignoble and unhappy regime that hold our brothers in South Africa, Namibia, in subhuman bondage, have been toppled, utterly downstroyed, well, everywhere is war. War in the East, war in the West, war up north, war down south. Yes, it's a war, herald a rumors of war. Yes, them war, oh, the rumors of war. Yes, until that day, the African continent will not know peace. We Africans will fight, we find it necessary. We know we shall win. We are confident into victory. A good over evil. A good over evil. A good over evil. Where everywhere is war. War in the East. War in the West. War up north. War down south. Yes, them war, them
And now for something completely different.